I know it's not turkey season yet, but look out, honey, because here come the colonel.
Yeah, yeah, you can't keep them out. The writers from Comedy Central keep sneaking in our studio. Well, there's another one. Welcome back to second half of The Promise of Tomorrow here on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host, I'm Colonel Mason. In this half hour, we have Joel Spark. Now, Joel Spark is an aerospace engineer from Canada creating an accessible, publicly available satellite platform to stimulate STEM education and serve the do-it-yourself space programs. Fascinating stuff. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. But right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information we have here on the set. Throw in some coins a little bit here and get an answer to today's query. What do you say?
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
As I see, we arouse the old spirit of the fountain by throwing in the coins. And, old spirit of the fountain, we have a history question for you now. Put on your thinking cap and remember, in 1950, there was a robbery, and the FBI spent 6 years and $129 million trying to solve it. Okay, so that's the question. What 1950 robbery did the FBI spend 6 years and $129 million trying to solve?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the others.
Ah, ha, ha. Yes, the spirit of the fountain knows all, hears all, sees all, and even tells all for a price. In 1950, the robbery the FBI spent 6 years and $129 million trying to solve was, of course, the Boston Brinks Express Company, or the Brinks Bank Job, huh? Remember that one. All right, back to our program. Well, today we have a treat. Every once in a while, we fall onto something that is, it can be really fun. And today we have with us Joel Spark. He's an aerospace engineer, born and raised in Calgary, Canada, but he's one of four co-founders of the ArduSat open source satellite project. And I don't know anything about it either, but they seek to create an accessible, publicly available satellite platform, and I've asked Joel to kind of drill down for us and give us, you know, the very basics of what exactly we're talking about. Welcome to the program, Joel.
Hi, Colonel. Thanks for having me.
Now, you know, let's get really elementary here. An accessible, publicly available satellite platform. That leads me to believe that there's going to be a satellite up in space someplace that I'm going to be able to access anytime I want to and do things with, and then I have no idea what the things are that I can do with. So why don't you start from the beginning? Let us know what we're talking about here.
Sure. So the ArduSat is what's known as a CubeSat. So it's a very small satellite. It's only around 1 kilogram, and it's the dimensions of it are only around 10 centimeters, 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters, so it's very small. And the idea is we put it in space and we build the bus, which is the non-functional part of the satellite. It's the part of the satellite that supports the brain. It supports what you want to do. So we build the bus and we take care of all that technical details. And the payload, which is the brain of the computer or the brain of the satellite, we make open source. We make the coding language is based off the Arduino, which is an open source platform that anyone can write code for. And anyone at home can buy an Arduino off the shelf, which is just a tiny little chip, write their own programs, and then upload them into space and actually run their programs in space.
Well, now, what... Okay. Let me summarize that just a little bit. You're going to put a very small satellite in orbit, and anybody can access it if they want to by using this this Arduino AVR-based computer, and then be able to access things in space and be able to run whatever programs we want to run, like what?
Well, it's really only limited by your imagination. So we're putting on the satellite, we're putting a sensor suite. So there's going to be about 25 different unique sensors, and that includes a camera and a spectrometer and a whole host of, you know, infrared thermometers and things like that, that you can decide which sensors you want to use, or even just use the camera and take pictures and take measurements. So, for example, I'm trying to think of some. We've had so many people in the last couple of weeks who have come up with ideas for the satellite. You could take the spectrometer and look at the sun, and you could sort of break down the wavelengths from the sun and actually verify that it matches the models, you know, that's published in textbooks. You could take measurements of the magnetic field. You know, there's a magnetic field sensor on there, so you could map the magnetic field of the Earth. You could do sort of less scientific things and do more game-oriented things. There's a Geiger counter on the satellite, so you could use it as a true random number generator. You know, every time you get a hit from radiation, you generate a number, and that's used in a game. One of the people even had the idea of using the steering system on the satellite that can make it turn different directions to try and make a social media game out of it, where different people try and raise votes that will turn the satellite to try and keep one side facing the satellite, one side facing away, and kind of do a tug of war with it. So it's really only limited by, you know, what you can come up with and what you can imagine up to do with the sensors that are on board.
Well, now, a lot of this data that you've just been talking about is already already available, and why would we want to do more mapping and those sorts of things of the sun? Are you just talking about these for hobbyists or for school you know, experiments or something like that? With this tug-of-war thing you're talking about, that's mainly just for fun, wouldn't you say?
Well, a lot of it is just for fun. One thing we've sort of run into is that a lot of people see space exploration as something that's only for, you know, the rich, or that's only for a public government to take care of. But what we see is that with this emergence of the CubeSat standard, it's becoming really, really affordable for people to use space technology. And that has a lot of, you know, practical implications. So, for example, you mentioned students, and that's a huge a group of people that have sort of joined onto the project is the student market. So there's high school students now who, instead of just learning about, oh, this is the magnetic field of the Earth and it's about this, you know, this strong at this height, you could say, okay, we'll teach you what that is, but now we'll actually give you time on the satellite to actually go and map it yourself and do it yourself and learn about it that way. It's the same way that the ham radio and the amateur radio band, it really gets people to learn and be excited about something themselves, you know, because they can actually go and do it themselves.
Well, now, my good friend Lee Goldberg, who put me onto this this story, tells me that CubeSat has really been around for a while. Is that right?
Yeah, the CubeSat was invented in 2003 by Cal Poly and Stanford, and it's really taken off in the last year or two. You know, there's been a couple of companies that have come up that are sort of designing off-the-shelf components for it. So now anyone can go and buy, you know, satellite parts and build their own satellite. So it's been around since for about 9 years now, but it's really been in the last 2 or 3 years that it's really taken off.
So this is really space satellite stuff for the tyro, for the hobbyist, for the student in elementary school that may want to play around a little bit with a satellite in space. Maybe akin to when a kid learned chemistry by having a chemistry set when he was 12 years old. Is that what we're talking about?
That's exactly right. And one thing that we found, one of the people on the project, her specialty was, or she did some research into sort of educational programs and what really sort of clicks with the people, you know, with young people today. God, I sound so old saying that. But what we found was that people are more excited about, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math, you know, the STEM fields. They really find it more exciting when they can do it themselves, when they can see the immediate results. You know, the same way that people are writing apps for their phones now. There was a great app that somebody wrote where you could point your phone at the sky, and it would use the gyros to know which constellations you were looking at and actually tell you which constellations, you know, you were looking at. And so that kind of thing where you can get immediate results, it really clicks and it really engages people. And so that's one very powerful thing about the system, is that it lets people really get immediate and direct results. You're not just waiting for the published values from NASA. You're actually going and getting them yourself.
All right, now once this is deployed, people like me or my grandson or somebody else can very cheaply get connected to the satellite. Explain, you know, the cost and how the process will work.
Sure. So the way it works is that you go online. We're building the web interface right now, and you'll essentially book time on the satellite. So if you say, I want it for the cheapest package we have right now is for about $350, you go on and you get 3 days of time on the satellite. So that's your time. You can do what you want. And if you want sort of more time, you can book more, obviously. And so once you have your time booked, you go on and you say, okay, I want to, for these 3 days, in the manifest, these will be my days. And you can start writing your code right away. So you can take your Arduino on the ground or your development kit on the ground, write your own code. We'll keep a copy of the satellite on the ground so that you can send us, via the internet, send us your code, and we can test it out to make sure it works. And once everything is working, then when your time comes up, your experiment gets uploaded into the satellite, and every time the satellite is in range of one of our ground stations, you can actually access it and say, okay, how's it doing? Maybe download some data. If I've taken some pictures, I can download those. Then at the end of your time, when your experiment's done, all your data is downlinked and sent back to you by the internet. So it's really something you can do sitting at home on your computer.
Well, that leads me, of course, to a bunch of other questions. One is that this satellite, you mentioned it being in range of your ground receivers. Is this satellite kind of hang out there in space all the time, or is this like the space shuttle that that disappears every 10 minutes, every hour or so, and you can't communicate with it?
So this satellite will be in low Earth orbit, so it'll be between 400 and 600 kilometers high, which means it goes around the Earth about every 90 minutes. So any ground station to be able to communicate with it, you actually need to be able to see the satellite. So we don't have any other satellites in space to bounce the signal off of at the moment. So that means we can access the satellite around every couple of hours. We've got a few ground stations spread around the world to try and improve that. And in the coming years, as we put up more and more satellites, we're planning on building more ground stations so that time actually comes down. But it's the kind of idea where every, at the very minimum, you'll hit a few ground stations per orbit, and it'll only be a few minutes lag time. But in the worst case, it'll be a couple of hours. That's the most you'll ever have to wait to talk to your experiment.
Now, you're not talking about putting up one satellite. You're talking about doing bunches of them. How are these things going to be regarded as more space junk or that sort of thing? What kind of complaints are you going to get there?
That was actually one big concern that people have raised with the space junk. That, if you're putting up all these small satellites and they don't have their own active propulsion, they can't steer and dodge things. And that's why we're actually shooting to put them in a very low orbit. So from the altitude that we're shooting for, they actually naturally fall down and burn up in the atmosphere around every 18 months to 24 months. They're very short lifetime. And that was somewhat intentional, actually. We want to have the latest technology actually on the satellite in space. The way satellites tend to be built now is that by the time it's actually in space, there's a lead time of 5, 10, 15 years, and the satellites themselves last another 5, 10, 15 years. So by the time they're actually at the end of their life doing science, they can have very, very old equipment in them. But by keeping the satellites very small, keeping them inexpensive, I should say, and replacing them frequently, you get the most bang for your buck. You're really using a modern computer and modern equipment. In terms of quantity that we're going to put up, the 1RG sat we're putting up now, it just passed its funding on Kickstarter, but that's just the beginning. It's scheduled to launch sometime in 2013, but that's really only going to be the first one. We're expecting that there will be lots and lots and lots of RG sats going up in the future. So that's why we need to keep the altitude fairly low and avoid creating space junk.
Okay, well, you kind of addressed that. Now, is there going to be a how-to prompting a program or something that'll give us step-by-step for teachers maybe to inform their students about how they're going to make use of this thing, or for the average Tyro to get involved with pulling something up and saying, okay, this is step one, this is step two, this is what I need to do, this is what I have to buy, and that sort of thing?
Absolutely. So we're trying to design the system so that anyone can use it. So for the do-it-yourself crowd, you know, the DIY group, they really like to build things from the ground up. And so we're setting it up so it's possible for them to do that. You know, you can really write your own code starting with a blank sheet. But we know that a lot of people don't like to do that. On the Kickstarter campaign that we ran, one of the most popular items was taking pictures. And we know a lot of you don't want to have to program the shutter on your camera. You know, you just want a functioning camera. So we've written a bunch of template programs, and we'll even have some just standard programs that you don't need to write. You just go online, and on the web interface, you say, I want to take a picture here. And that's it. It's a step-by-step. You say, I want to be in this position in orbit, looking this way, and I want to take a picture. And it'll all be handled. So for those who want to do it themselves, absolutely. You know, it's we've made the slate, and it's clean, it's for you. But if you decide you want to use a pre-built standard program, it'd be that as well.
All right, these pictures it'll take, they can take pictures of space, but you can also take pictures of Earth. I mean, could I, like, snoop on somebody that I didn't like or something very much in their backyard with a camera on this satellite?
You could, but they might look a little small. It'd be about one pixel. Because the satellite's so small, we have to squeeze a very small camera onto it. So it doesn't have very high zoom, but it's still a good enough picture to take, you know, a picture of your country. And we're looking at actually upgrading the camera because it was, you know, by popular demand, it was one of the most sought after items. So we're looking at upgrading it a little bit, but it's not enough to, you know, be snooping in your neighbor's backyard and see if he cut his lawn.
Yeah, well, I can imagine that the photos have got to be certainly something that's going to be in demand, and maybe even more in demand all along. Right now, I'm told by our Homeland Security people that we have cameras in space that shoot very minute and highly detailed from outer space down at ground level. And so I don't know if you'll ever get to that point or not. You told us how big this satellite is, and I kind of rushed to get my centimeter thing out and take a peek. But why don't you give us a description? Is this thing the size of a soccer ball, or what can we compare it to?
It's more of the size of a softball, actually. So it's only a few. I think I was raised metric. I'm from Canada, but it should be, I think, 2-3 inches. 3 inches along each side. So yeah, it's more the size of a softball. You can hold it in your hand, and it only weighs 2-3 pounds. So it's very light and very small. So that's one of the limitations in terms of, you know, taking these super high resolution pictures on the ground, is that you're limited by the size of the aperture. Of the camera that you can put in there. So the light gathering ability of the satellite can't compete with the 6-ton Earth observation satellites that are up there right now. But it's definitely good enough for photography. So yeah, you could look down at the Earth. With later satellites, we've designed with a higher accuracy, so we actually host telescopes, and not even optical telescopes, but you could have radio telescopes as well. So you could be looking outwards at the moon, or even deeper at the planets, or deep space. So.
Now, my friend Lee Goldberg, who, as I say, tipped me off to this story, said that there was one real novel backup way you had of getting it into space, and he said he wasn't going to tell me about it because he thought maybe you could, because he said it was really entertaining. What's he talking about?
So he's talking about a group that joined on very early on called Team Prometheus. And Team Prometheus is led by Monroe Lee King, Jr., and he's a space enthusiast currently in Austin, Texas. And he is entering into the NASA Centennial Challenge.
Mm-hmm.
And that challenge is to create a dedicated CubeSat launcher that can put CubeSats into space at the same cost of a ride-along launch. And so the way he wants to do it is to carry a rocket up to high altitude using a balloon. So it would be a balloon-launched rocket that would launch from, you know, above 100,000 feet and actually put it into orbit that way. So that system, he's hoping to get ready for the Centennial Challenge in a year and a half, and we're looking to design a payload for his launches as well. And if they work, then we will have our own launcher. So we don't even need to wait for a ride-along launch or International Space Station resupply mission. We could carry it up on a balloon and launch it from a balloon from high altitude. Team Prometheus is also helping us out, actually, with the test procedure. So in September, we're having a test launch with a high-altitude balloon to test the payload to make sure it works. And then we're going to put it on a suborbital rocket as well. So So it'll go up high into altitude to make sure that the satellite can withstand, you know, launch loads and a bit of radiation, and we sort of recover the payload and do tests on it that way.
All right, Joel, how about putting on the meditation cap for a minute and give us a view into the future? This can be a short range or a long range. It can be fanciful or it can be serious. What do you see? Give us a peek into the future.
In terms of CubeSats and in terms of sort of the DIY space, the do-it-yourself space movement, there's been a lot of traction, actually. And there's a lot of people getting involved now. In Germany, I'm working in Germany right now, and I visited a group of they call themselves hackers, and I think a lot of people associate hackers with illegal activity and with, with breaking into computer systems. But these guys are really just a group of space enthusiasts who want to build a do-it-yourself space program where you could have, as we're doing, have satellites in space that are totally run privately. They're totally just for amateurs to use. And they are also trying to build a ground station network. And the other interesting development that's been happening is the development of really, really small propulsion modules for CubeSats. So right now, CubeSats tend to be stuck in low Earth orbit because they're so small they can't fit any propulsion on them. But there's some really interesting things happening with propulsion miniaturization and actually solid rockets that you can turn on and off. And so there's a system that's being developed that could potentially put CubeSats in higher orbits and even start going out into deep space. So I predict that, with this, the rising of the DIY space and the advancements that are being made in propulsion, that we'll see a do-it-yourself satellite either around the moon or actually have something landed on the moon by, as early as 2020. And so by the end of this decade, I think we'll see some do-it-yourself space actually on the moon.
All right. Joel Spark, the aerospace engineer, one of four co-founders of the RDSat Open Source Satellite Project, creating an accessible, publicly available satellite platform for us all to use nice and cheaply. Thank you so much for being with us today. It's been really fun.
Well, thanks very much for having me, Colonel.
And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now, we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
It's that, where there's an abundance of victory, abundance of counselors, there is victory. And that's out of a proverb in the Bible. And I have always tried to surround myself with the right kind of counselors in many different aspects, both in personally in life and professionally. And it's no new creed, but it's one that I believe in greatly. And so I think that, if you think about this from a green energy perspective, well, there's an abundance of counselors, there's victory. And so those counselors that we're putting in place are these CEOs that can give us insight and wisdom as to what's going on in this world. Hi, my name's Kimo Storkey. I'm the CEO of CAS Consulting Group out of Austin, Texas.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.